This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello. What was the last live gig that you went to? Was it last week or last decade? As we know, we've heard one of our favourite sons, Darryl Braithwaite, is finally, he's had a good go at it, he's walking away from the live performances. I'd love to know your last live gig and how important live music is for you as we celebrate Darryl Braithwaite today. Also today, if you're going through IVF, have you ever asked for add-ons like acupuncture or steroids, thinking or maybe you were told that that will increase the chances of fertility? If so, there's a tough conversation that has to be had this morning. A new report says the majority of add-on treatments on offer are not at all useful in improving the chances of having a baby, or that the evidence is inconclusive. And some of these treatments are costing thousands of dollars. That's really hard to hear if you're maybe right now passionately throwing everything into your IVF experience, hearing something that you may have asked for or that your clinic has suggested or even just included is a waste of time and money. So soon on The Conversation Hour, we'll talk to the lead author of this report. I'd love to hear from you, though, also about the IVF you've gone through or that your loved ones have gone through, your experiences with add-ons. Not all, by the way, have been deemed totally useless. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking with someone who's been through the process and is passionate about people making informed decisions, going to reliable sources of information about add-ons. And also you'll hear exactly what the report found about the various treatments. That's coming up very soon on The Conversation Hour. Also today, does this sound familiar? Is this your day? Constant pressure to think clearly, to stay calm, to read people constantly and adjust your behaviour accordingly, to make decisions when there's uncertainty, to think clearly while you're jumping between tasks, to navigate the politics and not flip out all at the same time. To be honest, it's exhausting just reading it. It's familiar to me. I can feel it in my bones as even as I'm saying it. I bet it sounds very familiar to both, all of us, most of us anyway. Tell me if you're one of the lucky ones who doesn't feel that. It's what one of my guests is going today call emotional fatigue. It's an underlying factor of burnout. Are you burnt out? How do you cope with this emotional endurance? Not just the tasks you have to do, the emotional endurance of our day-to-day lives. Was there a point where you internally had to change your approach? Because many of us can't escape the context we're in, whether we're working or not. What part of your life drains you most? Is it the tasks or the people? We're going to learn in this hour about how to handle the emotional load. Tell me how you have learned to cope with emotional load. But next, the hard-to-hear findings about IVF add-ons.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So very soon I'm going to be speaking with someone who's been through the process and also is a co-author of this report, as well as the lead author of this report. But Lou in Elwood, you've had add-ons in your IVF experience. Is that right, Lou?
Yes, they weren't add-ons. I chose to do them myself, right, because my experience was 14 years ago. And in that time, the clinics didn't encourage it. In fact, the fertility doctor that I was seeing sort of laughed at me when I said our first round of IVF was heartbreakingly, you know, unsuccessful. And so I'm actually going to go and, you know, try and find anything that can complement the next round. Mm. And I saw a Chinese doctor, a fertility specialist in acupuncture and fertility and women's health. And the next round that I did, it was undeniably successful because of that treatment, I think. That was my experience.
In your mind, that was a direct relationship?
Oh, 100%. Like everything that they had you know, encouraged me to do diet, meditation, you know, just the acupuncture, the treatment that I was having. I felt really complimented. The medicine that I was taking, what I was doing with the IVF clinic. The IVF clinic didn't encourage it at all. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, after I was successful, had a live birth at full term, I went in again to do it a second time, and I was in my 40s by this stage. And at that time I had said to them, you know, you should really think about, you know, handing literature out, like, you know, because of my experience. I'd spoken to other women going through the same processes that had been going through them for years of unsuccessful IVF treatment, put them onto the doctor that I saw, the Chinese doctor, and they were having very successful results from that. So Lua, this is my experience. So, and then the second time, by the time I got there in 2015, that particular clinic that I was seeing had started to put the literature out for, if you want to go through these complementary treatments, you can do it.
Yeah. Lua, you're clearly speaking with a lot of certainty, and that's something in you that's really been part of your reflections of it since then. But I guess, can I ask you a tough question? In the light of today, we're talking about evidence, it's in the Lancet magazine, it's serious studies that have gone on with this that suggests that there is no evidence. Do you think at all, do you have any reflections on whether or not this could have had been a placebo as a factor? What do you think about that?
It could have been a placebo, but the point was, I felt in my journey that I was putting everything I possibly could in it. And that for me made, even if it didn't work and it was unsuccessful, I felt that I had done everything in my power. My husband also had some treatments as well. So just as a couple who are going through this really difficult process, felt that we had thrown. So there's no harm in that. And I do feel like positive thinking and just feeling supported by somebody else too, being able to go to a complimentary doctor just to have those conversations rather than just constantly feeling like you are in the hands of this one clinic, of this one fertility specialist, that that's all be an end all. And
that was useful to you.
100%, yeah.
Lou, thank you for calling and adding that to the conversation. I think it's really important to hear from the reasons, to hear from people about the reasons why they are going for this, even as we speak about this report today. Thank you, Lou. Deanna Carr is on the line as well. And as I say, Deanna has been through this. She's actually co-author of this report as well, because she's passionate about this subject of add-ons. Deanna, thanks for joining me. We've just heard from Lou there. How do you feel when you hear about that? Lou must be among many people who just feel like, look, why not do it anyway? Doesn't matter if it works or not. I feel I've done the maximum. How do you reflect on what Lou's saying?
I think, first of all, thank you for having me. I can really relate. Having done four IVF egg collections and seven embryo transfers to get my now 10-month-old daughter, when we were going through the process, I felt very much the same. I wanted no stone left unturned and wanted to throw everything at it, especially the more time went on, the more I was kind of willing to do and willing to try. We tried lots of different things, some that are on the website, some that are not. Done like the acupuncture Chinese medicine thing, steroids, blood thinners, embryo glue, something called LMIT, intralipid infusions, to name a few, as well as like a bunch of other kind of like immune protocols and medications. I guess like at the time you're like, I want to try anything, whether the evidence is there or not, because the last thing you want to do if your cycle doesn't work is, but what if I did that and that would have made the difference? And that's why I'm so passionate about this, like the website and like the paper is incredible, because it can be really difficult to make whatever decision, whichever way you're going, when you're going through IVF. And I think something that patients deserve is to be able to make a really well-informed decision with non-biased information. Mm. And that's one of the things that the website is so amazing for.
Yep. You're listening to Deanna Carr, who's been through IVF. We're talking about IVF add-ons in a new report today. And very soon we're going to be speaking with the lead author of that report. And we will go through exactly what was found to be somewhat useful in certain respects and other treatments that were found in this study to not be useful at all. So, Deanna, as I said, you've got that experience and you've been a co-author of this report. You talked about really needing to do everything you could at the time. What's your perspective now? And congratulations on your 10-month-old daughter, by the way. But what are your reflections now? What would you now be saying to people who are going through that journey about add-ons?
I think in having used significantly less add-ons in the transfer that resulted in my daughter, that was really eye-opening for me. But also, like, before we did her cycle, I was really torn on what to do. We had so many options to weigh up, some that I had considered myself, some were suggested by specialists, and then, of course, like, you know, listening to other people's experiences and reading through all the Facebook groups and forums, I was just overwhelmed with information and choices. And one thing that I guess I kind of would want people to know is that it's okay to take a few minutes. I know when it comes to IVF, it can feel like every minute, every day, every month is like precious because time is slipping away. But it's okay to like step back and think about what you want to do. And it's okay to go and like do like the actual research. And that's why the website is great, because it's using actual research.
And we will get to that website in a moment, but we've also heard, Deanna, that many people are reading stuff on social media and then also being confused, finding that even within a doctor's surgery, they might be recommended some of these things and they don't know how to have these conversations because you're in an intimidating space. What would you say to people who are in the middle of, as you say, all of this information firestorm?
Yeah, it can be really, really overwhelming and really intimidating, especially for a lot of people going through IVF. They're like, that's their real first medical experience aside from going to like the GP or the dentist. Like, not everyone has an experience of like seeing doctors frequently and often. So again, like, the website has a really great resource on how to actually talk to your doctor. I would say that, like, it's okay to like ask questions. Like, it's like the website is a great thing to like, you know, it's got like questions that you can specifically ask your doctor if you're looking for ideas, but you can write things down before you go in and you can kind of refer to the website while you're talking to them. Be like, I've seen this, I know you suggested this, but the evidence on this website says that it's not that effective. Like, could you maybe explain that a bit more? Or I've seen that this is a bit more effective, like, and I'd really like to try it. And it's not that any like decision is necessarily wrong or right. It's just about making sure it's the decision that you want and that you're well informed on the decision that you're making. Because the last thing anyone wants is any regrets, whether that means that their transfer has worked or hasn't worked. But it's a really difficult thing to sit with, and that's why I feel like it really has to be your decision, and the best way to make your own best decision is to be well-informed and to feel supported. And a lot of doctors are open to having those conversations. It can just be difficult on figuring out how to navigate it and to really kind of knock that power imbalance down again. But ultimately, your clinic wants you to have success as well, so those conversations are really important for that.
Deanna, thank you so much for joining the conversation today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Deanna Carr is obviously someone who's gone through IVF, and what a joy she has a 10-month-old daughter now. But that's talking about that really tough experience on the way with IVF. Just so you know, we will be talking as well about that website again with my next guest. But if you Google IVF University of Melbourne, you will find it. It is, in fact, evidence-based IVF information from the University of Melbourne. But as I say, joining me now is Dr. Sarah Lenson, who is lead author of that report and is from the Department of Obstetrics, Gynaecology and Newborn Health at the University of Melbourne. Sarah, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Just take it back to basics, if you could, for us. What are add-ons in the IVF space?
Sure. So Add-ons are sort of a broad term, I guess, for anything that's extra on top of the standard sort of required process of IVF. So they're usually something that patients sort of opt to have, and they're usually something that also costs them extra. And it can really cover a wide variety of things. So it can be medications that the IVF specialist might recommend or that patients might access over the counter. It can be procedures, extra procedures that might happen during the IVF process. It can be extra tinkering that's going on in the IVF laboratory with the eggs, the sperm or the embryos. And it can even be things that happen out in the community, like complementary and alternative therapies.
And your report's pretty stark. It's saying that there's no evidence or no conclusive evidence for most of the things you look at. You do say there's weak evidence, quote, for some possible benefit from three IVF add-ons. Can you tell us about those three?
Yeah, sure. So the three add-ons, we found sort of some level of possible benefit. So the first one's something called endometrial scratching, which is a, you know, somewhat painful procedure that involves scratching the endometrium, which is the inner lining of the uterus, before an IVF cycle. For that one, we found some possible evidence that it could increase the chance of getting pregnant and having a baby. The second one is something called PICSI, or physiological ICSI, which is sort of a special technique used to select the sperm that's going to be used for fertilisation. And for that add-on, we found that it might reduce the chance of miscarriage, but it doesn't seem to impact the chance of getting pregnant and having a baby. And the third one where we found some possible evidence is something called embryo glue, which is a special solution that embryo could be dipped into just before an embryo transfer. And for that one, it's a bit technical, but it sort of depends on how we run the analysis, what approach we take. Under one version, it looks like there's some benefit, but under the other version, it doesn't. So it kind of leaves us a bit unsure if there is a real benefit there or not.
And what are the ones that you found are basically useless, or at least where the results are inconclusive?
Yeah, so that's where the other seven fall. Some of them we have evidence and the evidence suggests it doesn't help. And for other ones, we don't have any evidence really, or any good evidence to kind of say one way or another. So it's a bit unclear. So in that first category where we do have some evidence and we're quite confident there is no impact on having a baby from IVF, one of the examples is the endometrial receptivity testing. So again, it's a bit of a mouthful, but this is quite a complicated add-on that involves taking a biopsy from the lining of the uterus and testing it for gene expression, and then changing the time that the embryo gets put back in a subsequent cycle, trying to, you know, it's this idea of trying to tailor the timing of the transfer to each specific woman's possible window of implantation, as they call it. So it's complicated, it's expensive, and it costs a lot of money, about $3,000. And for that add-on, we found there is evidence it's not going to help you have a baby from IVF. And on the other hand, an example of one where we don't know because the evidence is so unclear is something like platelet-rich plasma can either be injected into the ovaries or put into the uterus, with this kind of idea that these platelets taken from your own blood, from the patient's own blood, might in some way kind of rejuvenate the ovaries or the endometrium and lead to a better chance of pregnancy. That's the theory, but it's certainly not backed up by the evidence.
Not backed up by the evidence. You're listening to Dr. Sarah Lenson, who is lead author of this new report on IVF add-ons. On Conversation Hour, tell me, 1300 222 774, if you or someone that you know has been through IVF, you've maybe had some of these add-ons, your experiences, your thoughts, especially about hearing about the lack of evidence about most of these. Sarah, you talk about the cost, of course. What are the conversations that are behind the take-up of these add-ons? Is it exploitation, if you like, cynically, for money from clinics? Is it patients demanding it because they're desperate? Is it a mixture of both?
Yeah, I think it is a mixture of both. It's a mixture of a lot of things. So there is an element of patients sort of requesting these things from their clinicians. So, you know, especially after patients might have had one or two attempts at IVF and it's not working, there's sort of a natural inclination to sort of say, we need to do something different. This isn't working. What's going to change? Let's throw something else into the mix. And so patients might ask their clinician, what can we try? What's something that we could do differently?
And do you believe that they're taking their cues from social media in a lot of cases?
Yeah. So I think a lot of the time patients like to, do their own research, so to speak, and they jump online and there's high volume of posts and information sharing on social media platforms, on Facebook and on Reddit, where patients are discussing their experience of different add-ons, what they've tried, sharing their anecdotes of success or not, and also asking their peers for advice on what might work. And so there's a lot of ideas being kind of thrown around there, and then patients sometimes take those into the clinic and ask their doctor if they could try them.
So patient-led pressure on one hand. Mm-hmm. I used the word exploitation before about clinics. I mean, that's a very strong word. What is happening on the clinician side? Are clinicians reflecting back the lack of evidence when patients do actually ask for?
Yeah, I think it's really clinician dependent, but clinicians definitely do play a role in making patients aware of these add-ons. I mean, we've previously reviewed IVF clinic websites across Australia and found that I think it's over 70% of websites list one or more of these add-ons as being available at their clinic, and often the information that accompanies that content on the clinic websites is kind of overstating the potential benefit, overpromising, and downplaying the fact that there's limited evidence or that there's high costs or possible risks. So clinicians and clinics definitely play a role in increasing the availability of the add-ons, and it's very clinician dependent, but a lot of clinicians like to use these add-ons in their treatment as well, and they'll offer them to patients. And it's not always clear to patients that these are optional and these are not possibly mainstream and used by everyone. We've heard patients tell us that their clinician kind of gave them all these prescriptions for all these extra medications and didn't explain the fact that these are usually optional and that there are some risks and costs associated with them.
To play devil's advocate, there may be clinicians or people who trust their clinicians who've suggested this, who may not be who may not agree with what you've come up with. What would you say about that, the clinicians who potentially are doing this in quite good faith?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really is tricky for the clinicians because we're kind of in this situation because the evidence base is so poor at the end of the day, which we've highlighted in our paper, that a lot of the time there's these studies kind of come out, maybe they get presented at a conference and there's a kind of suggestion of possible benefit. And rather than waiting, years for the big, robust, randomized control trial to come out and tell us if it works or not, clinicians can feel some pressure to start offering these treatments to their patients. If there's a signal or something that they perceive is good enough evidence that they want to start using them. But I think at the end of the day, the main thing is that the patients have the facts for themselves, so they understand how good the evidence is supporting these options, and they can kind of make their own decisions.
You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We're talking about a new report that's found very little evidence for the efficacy of IVF add-ons, and Dr. Sarah Lenson is with me. Sarah, is there any government regulation around this or steps towards it?
There certainly has been a bit of a shake-up, I guess, or like a re-look at the regulation that's happening in Australia. And the Fertility Society of Australia and New Zealand has been really proactive about trying to push for kind of national regulation across the board in the IVF space. So there might be a move for more regulation in this space, but I think the key thing is that patients have the evidence, and that's why we have developed this new resource, evidence-based IVF, that we launched about a year ago. It's free to access for everyone in the world. It gives them impartial, evidence-based information about these different treatment options, whether it looks like the evidence shows it can increase the chance of getting pregnant or having a baby from IVF, and what the effect is on miscarriage. It covers costs, practical considerations, sort of everything that patients might need to know before they go into the clinic and discuss them with their doctor. And, we kind of hope that patients will feel more empowered, that they've got the facts, and then they can make whatever decision they feel is right for them.
I believe you talked about it with the Conversation Hour audience last year, this tool. What are the details for that? How can people access it?
Sure. So I suppose the easiest way is to Google evidence-based IVF University of Melbourne, as the website sits on the University of Melbourne website, and they should be able to find it there.
Is it a challenge to be fighting against the social media algorithms that some people are accessing?
It sure is. And also with AI now, you know, there's a lot of that little meta AI box thing that comes up when you run your Google searches. We have tried to, as best as we can, kind of tailor our content so Google trusts us and we can feature in that meta AI overview. So it is a problem, but I guess I'm hopeful that, you know, our website is viewed as trustworthy by the bots and by the patients, and hopefully with more and more use it will continue to have good exposure on the internet.
Dr. Sarah Lenson, thank you for joining me.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Sarah Lenson is the lead author of that report. And for the people who are asking again, Sarah said the site, I found that website just by Googling IVF University Melbourne. It'll come up as one of the first responses, Google or whatever search engine you use. This on text 6 years ago when I was going through IVF, there were various add-ons offered. After 5 unsuccessful attempts, I booked in to see a naturopath as recommended by the clinic. Before the naturopath appointment, I found out I was pregnant on my 6th attempt without any of the add-ons and went on to have a healthy baby with no add-ons. Everyone's story is different. And I guess, yes, that does seem to be the bottom line, even from the people who are talking behind this report, saying everyone has, of course, their choice to do whatever they feel is right, but go to that reliable source of information. It is the Conversation Hour, and very soon I'm going to be talking about emotional overload, but I also want to ask you, what was the last gig you went to? When was it? Was it last week or was it 10 years ago? How important is live music as we farewell Darryl Braithwaite from the live stage? Darren in Wangaratta, when was your last live gig?
Last Thursday night at the Opera House.
Oh, right. Who to?
I went to see ARC, Australian Rock Collective, play Hotel California.
Oh, wow. Mm,
it was
so
great.
In the Opera House?
Yeah, yeah. Saw them a few months back and they did Pink Floyd tribute.
Fantastic. And so is Hotel California, it's not just the one song then?
No, I know. They did the whole album. They did two albums.
Oh, terrific. How important is seeing live music to you, Darren?
It's become more important as I got a bit older. My partner's in a wheelchair and we travel around a little bit, stay overnight where we can and catch live music. And, it's a big part of our recreation now.
Yeah, that's interesting that it's becoming more important, maybe for all of us as well, when we're becoming more disconnected. I want to hear from you throughout this Conversation Hour. Is it the same? Darryl Braithwaite just talked this morning about how much he's going to miss live music. What does it mean to you? Trish in Brighton, when was the last gig you went to? Hello, Trish.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. What's your last gig you went to?
Sunday. We went up to see Ross Wilson and his band play at the St Andrews Pub. It was just fantastic. It was packed. Absolutely chockers.
Oh, that's great. Do you agree with Darren that maybe it's becoming more important to you?
Yeah. Well, look, I've always loved music and I love live music, but I think it's a great relief from the mess the world's in.
Trish, I completely agree, and it segues very nicely to my next guest. Keep those calls and texts coming about live gigs and how important live music is. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. But yes, Trish talks about the state the world is in. We are all facing a little bit of emotional overload. Stay tuned for some advice and tell me your trick to stay calm and relatively sane.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So many of us described ourselves as burnt out, and it sometimes doesn't even matter if you're working or not. That burnout, lying just below it, could be that feeling of just being emotionally exhausted, having too much load on one's internal work. How do you get around it? What do you find more draining? Is it the tasks you need to do during the day, or is it the people that you have to deal with and all the internal work that you have to do? And what's your tip? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Phil Slade is a behavioural economist, and he has penned a piece for Money Magazine on work burnout and this emotional load. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
That's great to be here.
Phil, you've written that people aren't necessarily tired because they're busy or because of their tasks. It's because work has become emotionally demanding. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's one of the big sort of misconceptions that if you're exhausted, that you just need to reduce the workload and you'll be less exhausted. And there's an element of truth to that, of course. But the reality of today's workplace is that you can't always do that. And you can sort of look at two people and two people have got the same workload. One person's more exhausted than the other. And you go, well, what's the difference between those two people? And you realize that our brains have got a limited bucket of emotional energy. And so if we're spending too much emotional energy on a particular thing or a particular person or a particular task, that becomes like a little energy vampire that kind of sucks our energy out, right? And so therefore it's not actually the work or the context it's our reactions to that context or that work, which is actually the thing that's draining us emotionally. Mm. We obviously have the physical drain if your work is physical, and there is an element of, if you're completely overworked, of course, but I don't think we're necessarily talking about that. We're talking about how do we better navigate the workload that we've got in order to be able to navigate life as we know it.
Mm. And you're talking about, for instance, one person being an emotional vulture, I think you called it. So it's not just even one person, is it? It's about a multitude of things feeding into it.
Well, sometimes, for instance, when you first get promoted into a new job or a new context, you've got all of these contexts that you're not that experienced with. And whenever you have to do this thing called context switching, so you might be in one conversation here and then you're having a strategy conversation, then you're on the front line doing something for a client or a client focus. And that context switching, particularly when you are not used to it, can be incredibly draining. And so one of the things to go, okay, well, why is that draining that cognitive energy, and how can you lessen that energy? And one of the ways that you can do it is just become more and more familiar, so a little bit more preparation so that you don't have to do that context switching and take in all that information is one of those things. But another one that is with the new people, particularly if there's somebody or people, the interpersonal dynamics, which are a little bit strained, that can have a massive impact on your ability to be able to or a massive drain on that emotional bucket. And those emotional vampires, as I call them, sometimes we need to either make sure that we don't be around the people that are draining, or we can start to look at, well, why is that person draining me so much, and how can I lessen the drain of that person? So it could be about reframing, it could be about breathing, all sorts of things that we can do there.
Okay, we will get to that in a second, but I want to hear if anyone else has tips, what has maybe changed for them, how they've reframed their work life, their home life to overcome this emotional load. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. 0437 774 774 to text. So, Phil, I should ask, your top tips about being in this situation, feeling that overwhelm when you're already trying to do everything you can to keep a lid on it. What's the difference between keeping a lid on it and dealing with it?
Yeah, there's a big difference. So keeping a lid on it is literally, as you said before, just trying to find calm and find peace in that moment. It's almost an advanced version of suppression, and that can work. Like that it's not to say that doesn't work at times, but a lot of the time that act of suppression, particularly if someone there's an unjust situation or they're particularly patronizing or something like that to you, and it takes a lot of effort just to suppress that emotion. That in of itself is very draining. And so you've got to be able to look at that emotion and go, okay, how can I start to learn how to better dial up and down my emotions and just see that in that moment? So I'm irritated, and just let yourself be irritated with that person. Don't try and not be irritated, but also don't be furious. And so therefore you can start to look at almost like a scientist of your own emotions and be happy that well, not happy, but be content and non-judgmental about the emotions that you're feeling, but just feel them at a much lower level. Mm. And I think that that's a better way to think about controlling those emotions, as opposed to, I have to look like I'm happy all the time or cheerful. It's just that I'm allowed to be irritated, but if I get frustrated, I know that I'm a bit out of control. And if I'm furious and trying to suppress that fury, that's when I'm really draining my emotional energy and I'm going to be exhausted within half an hour, let alone by the end of the day.
Mm. You write also that younger generations are better at calling this out, at naming the stress and questioning unsustainable work. There are probably listeners who fall into the category of, well, you know, they just have to toughen up. Are they getting it right? Or, you know, is there a certain element where there does need to be resilience along with everything you're saying?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, whenever we talk about a group of people collectively, there's going to be some truth to that, and case studies where it doesn't work. So there is that. But generally speaking, we didn't know this level of emotional intelligence. What I've just explained to you about looking at that emotions in that slightly more scientific way is not something that we grew up in the 80s or the 90s or even the early noughties talking about or doing. The kids these days with the social emotional learning and things we're doing at school are only just sometimes are more skilled in that area, because this is an area of emotional intelligence, and emotional intelligence is a skill that you can practice and build. And so I think with what education is doing nowadays, it is actually preparing our kids a little bit better emotionally than what we were being prepared, even though there's always going to be some case studies of some people that haven't built that skill and are quite skill-less when it comes to this. So I think it's a really interesting emerging pattern of behavior when the next few generations are starting to come through, being a little bit less judgmental about their emotional state, but also being a little bit more in control of it and having what we call emotional agency. And that's where we're trying to build. That's the skill of emotional agency, where we can use our emotions in order to motivate us, in order to do things and feel like we're more in control of our own self rather than just being subservient to the things around us that are going to buffet us and inspire that thought that just toughen up, because it's about you buffering the external energy. No, you don't have to toughen up so much if you've got control of it in the first instance.
Yeah. You're listening to Phil Slade, psychologist and behavioural economist. Why can't I say that today? And we are talking about, maybe I've got too much emotional load on my plate, how we cope with that internally. Robin Hayfield has texted Phil and saying, I was in a job I enjoyed for 40 years. The inept toxic management structure that built up over the last 15 years made it an unpleasant place to be. I retired, problem solved. I guess just to finish on, what would you say about that line? When would we recognise that it's not the internal work we need to do, it's something else, it's moving on, it needs much more than reframing?
Absolutely. Particularly in a toxic environment where you've got experiences that we call trauma experiences, where it's been really difficult, it's almost impossible to heal in the environment that hurt you. And so in that instance, you really do sometimes need to move out of that environment in order to retrain your brain to go, well, not all people are like that, not all workplaces are like that, and reestablish your sense of self and agency to go, I am competent, I am good at what I do, I do enjoy what I do. And from the opposite, from the boss's perspective, you know, if you're in charge of other people creating that culture, one thing to remember is you can't create good well-being in the people that you're overseeing, but you can screw it up. And so it's like, how do you create the opportunity, the best environment for people then to step into in a psychologically safe and connected way, and then realize that it's also up to those people to step into that environment. So it's a two-way interaction of both creating the right environment, but also the individual stepping into that right environment. And that's where we get good workplace culture.
Mm. Phil, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too, anytime.
Thank you. That's Phil Slade, who's a psychologist, and he's penned a piece for Money Magazine on that burnout and that topic, if you'd like to look a little bit more into it. Simon says, stress can be from a busy mind and catastrophizing. I find preparation, verbalizing the issues, and being honest helps. Action releases stress better than inaction. And Solange in Northcote says that after working for many years helping people with psychological injuries in their workplace and as a result suffering from emotional fatigue, being unable to work myself, my experience is that not exposing myself to any further stress or as little as possible has been most effective. Lowering my expectations is a great part of this. Keep those texts coming if you have any other tips as well. Also, maybe how you get over that emotional fatigue is looking forward to some live music. Darryl Braithwaite won't be there to help you. That's harsh, isn't it? He has, after many, many illustrious years, stepped off the stage. He won't be having live performances. So I'm asking you, how important are live gigs to you still? When was the last one you went to and what was it? Jeff in Traralgon, what did you want to say?
Mary, I belong to a small club in Gippsland called Gippsland Acoustic Music Club, based in the Latrobe Valley. It's auspiced by Community Music Victoria, which oversees a whole range of small music groups who put on performances weekly, monthly, sometimes quarterly, right across the state to engage people, both performers and the audience, in the language of music. And, you know, what that could be, there's plenty of dialects there. So The importance of it is incredible, the amount of engagement that occurs, because the people who come to listen to music come from all different backgrounds. They could be full-time workers, retired, young children, and the ability to be able to have a venue to perform, if you're a performer, to go to a small venue where there's 40 or 60 or 100 people who actually want to listen to your music. It's not like being in the pub where you're just making a bit of noise in the background while everybody's drinking and talking. It's actually delicate and precise, and it, you know, can be active or just passive. It's all of those things, and it's an opportunity that there's lots of Victorians may not even know that this organisation exists and has all these performances happening right across the state. You know, weeknights, weekend nights, and all of that.
Tell us the details again, Jeff.
It's to find out all the all where things are, go to the Community Music Victoria site. That's cmvic.org.au. But the little club I come from, Gippsland Acoustic Music, we have concert nights, we call them, on Sundays, the first Sunday of the month. In wintertime, it's from 3 to 5, and in summertime, it's from 7.30 to 10. So, there you go.
Get out there and join those gigs with Jeff. Thank you so much for letting us know about that, Jeff. Yes, I love your description as well about a place where people gather and have that community. It reminds me of that great trip we had to Mill Park Library last week, a place where people gather from all different backgrounds and just enjoying something. But of course, I don't know how much you can dance in libraries, even modern libraries. We're asking you, how important are live gigs to you? 1300 222 774. Tell me about the place in your life for live music, the last gigs you went to. Was it last week, just the day before? Or was it 10, 20 years ago? Tell me about your relationship with live music. Joining me now to talk about Darryl Braithwaite and also potentially to give him some tips about life beyond the live stage, Russell Morris, music legend, joins us on The Conversation Hour. Thank you so much, Russell.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm really well.
Yeah.
What did you think when you heard this news?
Darryl contacted me. Yeah, he contacted me he's just been over in Europe, and he contacted me and let me know what was happening, and because we're pretty good friends, and it's very sad that it's happened. Everything must come to an end. That's the way of the universe. So he decided that it was time to pull the plug, and I respect his decision, and he's given so much. He's been a wonderful performer with incredible records, and also a very honest and down-to-earth guy, a fabulous guy, very true of heart. He's one of those guys.
Yeah, so much of the tributes that have been flowing about him this morning have not just obviously been about his success, but about him as a person.
Oh, he's an incredible person. He's not impressed by anything. I'll ring him sometimes. I'd ring him up and I'd say, "Where are you?" And he said, I'm up camping on the New South Wales coast. Oh, yeah, what are you doing? Who are you up there with? No, I'm not with anybody. I've just come up here. I've got my tent and I'm on the beach. Like, are you serious? And that's the way he was. He was just so casual. And he's never been, a big noter or anything like that. Yeah. He's just one of those very humble men, lovely person.
Yeah. On the Conversation Hour, I'm asking you your relationship with live music. Is it still important to you? Tell me about the last gig you went to. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. With me is Russell Morris. And I will ask you soon about the status of your farewell tour. We know that you did one, but is it really over? Let's have a listen, though, to Daryl Braithwaite speaking this morning to RAF on Mornings when he was talking about giving up live music. And just have a little listen to how he speaks about the whole process of touring and performing.
I love every aspect of it, from getting up in the morning, packing the bag, getting in the car, onto the bus, then into the plane, then into the hire car, and then to the motel, then sound check, then the gig, then all that. It's and then playing, obviously, and reaction. And like everyone that sings or plays in a band, that applause and stuff, which people don't get in everyday jobs, you know, but we do. We're fortunate.
You can hear there, Daryl Braithwaite, with the breathing problems that have led him to this decision, but also with that love of the live performance. Russell Morris, how hard will it be for Daryl to give up that performance, that experience, from your own experience of facing this?
For Daryl, I think it'd be quite painful, because as you heard what he said, Daryl loved the band was his family, and that's all he looked forward to, going away, touring. He would take breaks at times, like for 3 months, and he would go back, but that's what he lived for. And it'll be a hard cross to bear for him for a while. But I said to him, he can come down to my place and stay with me, and I've got an extra rocking chair and a really well-used pair of slippers that I don't use anymore. We can use those, and we can sit there and chew over the cud.
We should put a mic next to you and have one, some sort of rocking chair gig session there, I reckon. Go off well. Paul in Ballarat, what did you want to talk about with live music?
Oh, hi, Mary. I actually am very lucky, and I know Russell, and great to hear his voice. I'm the MC for the Red Hot Summer Tour, which is regional Australia's biggest concert tour, which Russell's been a part of a number of occasions. But you know, I see the passion in the punters week in, week out. They come, they buy their tickets, they can't wait to see live music. And thankfully, I've had the opportunity to work with Daryl on a number of occasions on the Red Hot Summer Tour as well. And, you know, you won't find a better bloke. And humble is a great word to use where Daryl Braithwaite's concerned. And it was always great to see him come on site and get ready for his show. And he was a keen photographer.
Right.
He used to sneak around side of stage, Mary, while the other acts were playing, and you'd see him taking his photos. It was just, he's just a terrific bloke, and he'll be sadly missed.
Oh, maybe he's got a coffee table book coming out soon then, maybe, with behind
quite
the scenes.
Possibly.
Quite possibly. Paul, thank you, and, yeah, congrats on being able to do that. Kate in Bentley, what did you want to say about live music?
Oh, yeah, hello. Look, I just wanted to say how important it is, and an example, my 18-year-old son, he turned 18 2 weeks ago, went to his first live gig at the Forum last week to see a band that's been around since the 90s. So seeing the crowd come out, it was all older people and a whole lot of younger people as well.
What was the band?
Stereolab.
Did you go with him?
No, he went with a friend. Going with his mum to his first gig would be a bit daggy.
but he said the
atmosphere was so amazing, and the old people, they called them, so, you know, people in their 50s, pushed the kids up to the front so they could have a great experience. And he said it was such a visceral experience to just feel the music in his body and just had the best time, yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, that must have filled you with a bit of joy. Hearing that.
Oh, so much joy. Yeah, so much joy. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful thing. Live music's so important. We really need to preserve it. Yeah.
You're going to talk with him about his next gig?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And Daryl Braithwaite, good for him retiring. What a lovely guy. I've met him a couple of times. Just a beautiful, beautiful man. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Kate, thank you. Russell Morris has been listening on, himself a legend. And I have to bring it up. You've finished your farewell tour. Is it again, goodbye from the stage for you. You seem to have been a bit cagey. Is it Never Say Never?
If a one-off show came up or something really, really interesting came up that I could do, but I would never tour again because the touring, I was the opposite to Daryl. I didn't like touring very much. I didn't like the getting to the airport, getting the hire car, going to the hotel. You go to the hotel and you find that the venue's quite away from the hotel. So you drive to the venue, do sound check, but it's too far to go back to the hotel and have a shower and get ready for the show. So you're stuck at the venue for another 4 hours and then you do the show and then repeated that to me became really mundane after a while. I loved the performing, but if I could be transported on the stage, do the show, and then just that's it. That would be fantastic.
Teleportation, and you'll stick with it.
Yeah. So that's the only other thing. If something really unusual came up, I would consider it. But something just did recently come up. Joe Camilleri got very sick with the Capretto's. He had fluid in his lungs, and thankfully he's well now, which is great, but he couldn't do three shows up in Queensland. They rang me and said, will you do them? And I said, listen, the Capretto's. I started the Capretto's with all the guys, so yes. So I went and I did three shows with them, and that was lovely. It was fun, really enjoyable, but I'm quite happy doing my songwriting. I spend time songwriting most days. And I'm just enjoying that. It's because that's my main love.
Yeah,
writing songs.
So that's the bit of your identity that you're keeping, even if you have to say goodbye to that. Yeah.
Yeah, forever. Yeah,
Russell Morris. There'll be so many people listening who say never, never stop. Thank you so much for joining us on Conversation Hour today.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Thanks very much.
That's Russell Morris, of course, played in that band with Daryl Braithwaite and knows him well. It's a passing of an era, isn't it? Thank you so much for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. Lots of really heavy but also some light conversations, and really love talking to all of you. You can listen to all of it again on the Conversation Hour on the ABC Listen app. Just look up the Conversation Hour, and also give me an email, conversationhour@abc.net.au, if you think I should be following anything on this program. Talk to you again tomorrow.